you, Jerry. Our third presenter is Bob Royal, who is president of the Faith and Reason Institute here in Washington, D.C. His books are listed on the bio data sheet that we handed out. Some of the books, too long a list to repeat. He has taught at Brown University, Rhode Island College, and Catholic University. He's a regular columnist for Crisis magazine, and his articles have appeared in a number of journals, including First Things, the National Review, and the American Spectator. Bob?
Well, I'd like to thank David for inviting me here, and since he mentioned that he's trying to get a broad set of views here, I assume that my role is to be part of the broadness, because I disagree rather significantly with some of the things that have been set up till now. However, at the same time, there's a certain overlap in the way all of us approach just war, all of us who take seriously the just war principles. So what I'm going to try to do a bit is to summarize without repeating some of the things that have gone before. So please bear with me as I try to do that. I think one of the most fruitful ways to think about what we have in front of us, although this may sound slightly academic for so practical a question as just war in Iraq, is to really think of this as a textbook case, or a case that ought to become one of those exemplary textbook things that we study, precisely because, as Jerry just mentioned, we do live in different circumstances than prior to 9/11. And while, as he rightly said, in part that has something to do with changed perceptions, I would argue that it also has to do with a changed reality. And under those circumstances, whether or not it will be permissible to engage in preventive or preemptive warfare should be central to our just war thinking at this moment after 9/11, in the same way that ideas like mutual assured destruction and no first use were debated back during the Cold War when the United States and the Soviet Union faced each other with many serious nuclear weapons. So we will have to think creatively about these issues. We will have to allow for the possibility that the international, that the world community will at times be required to take strong action to preserve peace and international order. And I don't think that it's helpful for us simply to kind of invoke mechanically certain categories of just war tradition, which I'm going to come back to in a minute, and demanding proof of an immediate threat. I think that our situation has changed significantly enough that we have to expand those categories somewhat to take into account our new moral situation, not only vis-a-vis Iraq, but about the whole post-Cold War world. Now, obviously, many reasonable people disagree about that assessment. For such people, the American determination to disarm Iraq or change the Iraqi regime must be limited, as we've heard, by traditional just war rules, as those have been interpreted in recent decades. Now, I would just point out, since James Turner Johnson has been invoked, that there is a significant scholarly community on just war that is seeking to reach back to a wider interpretation of just war, of what just war sanctions and what it prohibits. And just to give you an example, if someone had argued on September 11th of 2001 that the al-Qaeda training camps in poor, backward Afghanistan under the Taliban posed an immediate threat to the United States and the rest of the civilized world, that person would have been regarded, quite rightly, as mad. Yet that was precisely what those training camps were. And I would argue, both morally and militarily speaking, there is not a immense difference between the brutal regimes developing weapons of mass destruction and those al-Qaeda camps that we thought in the past did not present to us a clear and present danger. Both are intended to be used for nefarious purposes. As Aristotle once said, no one becomes a dictator merely to keep warm. And it is also true, I believe, that no one develops weapons of mass destruction simply to keep them on the shelf. They are intended to be used for some purpose, and those purposes must be carefully thought about. So I do not think we absolutely need to decide whether these weapons present a clear and present danger. Clearly, given a globalization of terror, along with a globalization of many other things, these weapons do present such a danger. And therefore, what we really need to do is to develop some principles by which we will seek to govern preventive or preemptive action, since we may find ourselves facing many instances in which such things have to take place. Now, I've debated this issue a number of times since September 11 in Europe, where criticism of U.S. policy is a lot less muted and is a lot more widespread than it is here in the United States. But really, it's not all that much different from our homegrown opposition to the war. And I'm going to just take on two questions that I think kind of formulate what the objections are for the sake of saving time. One is, why Iraq? And the other, which Jerry mentioned in passing, is why now? Why Iraq question, I think, arises because, as we all know, there are many regimes in the world that oppress their own people, threaten their neighbors, and are developing worrisome weapons of mass destruction. And obviously prominent among them is North Korea. Why now is raised because the Iraqi threat clearly has existed for a long time. It doesn't seem to offer any sharp divergence from what we have lived with for years, as Jared mentioned, that would justify an immediate use of force. And then there are the many other subsidiary questions about prudential matters. Won't this evoke even greater Arab hostility toward the United States, even more widespread terrorism, turmoil, set a bad example, cause even greater protests in Hollywood, and all sorts of other unpleasant consequences. But let's just stick with these two main questions to begin with. First, why Iraq? This question, I find, usually comes up as if the history of Saddam Hussein's regime since the 1980s is unimportant precisely because we know it so well. I mean, as Jerry said, what's there new about it that wasn't there 4 or 6 years ago? I think that history tells us an opposite story. When I first came to Washington 20 years ago and the Israelis bombed the Osirak nuclear facility in Iraq, I thought that they were way outside just war categories, that this was the sort of thing that just war categories were precisely intended to keep us from doing. In retrospect, I think they were right and I was wrong. If we had to confront Iraq with nuclear weapons today, we would be even in a far worse situation than we find ourselves. I think that also there is a tendency among people of cynical inclinations, I won't say Europeans, but especially in Europe, to dismiss arguments like this as mere rationalizations. For lots of people, the war on Iraq is really about oil, or it's about some other dimension of American self-interest. I find most of these arguments fall apart almost on immediate, even a minimum analysis. To begin with, as we know, the United States only gets about 6% of its oil from Iraq, an amount that can easily be made up from other sources. If current administration were really concerned about oil supplies, probably the best thing it could do would be to hold its nose and make its peace with Saddam Hussein, since that would at least guarantee us a status quo in the Middle East. I think that we have to say that these attempts to explain what the United States is intending to do as motivated by other interests are really off target, and that what really concerns us are specifically those things that we have seen in the past that we know since the end of the inspection regime in 1998 must have continued without our knowledge, and that in the post-9/11 circumstances can't help but provoke any responsible statesman to think that some measures must be taken to make sure that another horrible event like September 11th does not occur. Let me just go through things that we all know, but just to make sure we know what we're talking about. We're talking about a specific country that has used nerve gas on its own people and on Iran, invaded another country and was ousted militarily, So if we want to talk about aggressive warfare, we must begin with a different understanding of the position from which we begin. And it's not just Jim Turner Johnson's idea that the truce has been abrogated by the failure to continue the inspection regime, that in fact we have a regime which we know has recently engaged in military adventures and is now maybe developing weapons to continue that possibility again. It has ignored the wishes of the international community. And here I really want to emphasize something that I think the European case underscores for us. It's true that the Bush administration's unilateralist rhetoric has annoyed a lot of people. But it's my reading of the situation that without that stick as well as the carrots that the Bush administration holds out, Europeans and the world community generally would not have moved very well on this case. The Europeans, generally speaking, do not act even in their own backyard. We know that without American leadership, the situation in Kosovo would not have been dealt with very easily. And therefore, there is both a moral as well as a military leadership function that the United States is able to carry out and to put in front of the international community when that international community itself is not taking seriously its own obligations. I started out by saying that this Iraq case is sort of a textbook case, and part of that textbook case is, does the international community have enough united will to enforce the kinds of difficult sanctions that it imposes on regimes like Iraq? If it can't do that, if it is unable to make it clear to other regimes of a similar nature around the world that there are real consequences to be paid vis-a-vis the international community, then the international community, in my view, is essentially a nice place to talk. It's good to develop international legal principles, but it is not the kind of moral instrument that we need in the world today. I think in this regard that the former President Carter made an interesting comment in his Nobel lecture. He said, and I'll quote here, "For powerful countries to adopt a principle of preventive war may well set an example that can have catastrophic consequences," a very good thing to remind us all of. But I think that there's a correlative principle here too, and I'll formulate this in my own terms, and it would go something like this. For powerful countries and the international legal order to fail to find principles for the kind of preventive war current conditions demand may well set an example that can have catastrophic consequences as well. Among these, I would add inviting adventurous dictators to develop weapons of mass destruction and allowing those developments to go so far that no country, however powerful, will want to challenge such dictators. As Henry Kissinger has said recently, these sorts of circumstances force us to say not that preventive war or preemptive war is impossible, but to find conditions under which we believe circumstances are so difficult that we must use such means. I want to emphasize the newness of the situation, because I hear in some commentaries that what we are doing is going back to a situation prior to the development of international law in which states will kind of on their own make up rules for when they feel that they can attack another nation. I don't think that's at all what's going on. I think that the recognition that we have to confront these threats is actually a progressive development, an understanding that if the world is ever truly to get to the stage where international law is going to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction by one country on another, that we all must work together at a moment that offers us a certain opportunity that may lead us into an age in which we will not have to resort to such things. Now, President Carter made a statement at Oslo that roughly said what I just said, if not in as lapidary fashion as the other remark of his that I quoted. This was little noted at the time, but he said that we have a need to make all nations respect international agreements and prevent proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. The problem with the way that he and I think many other people kind of conceptualize this is that they assume then that the international community without resort to military means in situations like this is somehow going to be effective. I don't think that it can be. And my judgment is admittedly a prudential judgment, but just to kind of take the recent history of sanctions in the world, I don't think that they don't offer us a very optimistic prospect. Sanctions, in my view, in modern times have failed everywhere they've been tried, whether it has been North Korea, whether it has been Cuba, or whether it has been Iraq. The one exception that I can think of possibly is the apartheid regime in South Africa, and I think there the sanctions succeeded, not so much because they harmed South Africa economically as the fact that South Africa shared with the rest of the West a certain number of values, and its leaders eventually came to see that apartheid was not part of those Western values and simply changed. So I don't believe that we have many other means, and it's I think it's not helpful for the Catholic bishops. Jerry, I think, made a very powerful statement of some other principles, but it seems to me that in the statement that Bishop Gregory read in September, the kind of teeth that he put into the bishop's thinking about just war was not present. And I'd like to just read you a couple of remarks of theirs. In that September statement, the bishop said, "The Iraqi leadership must cease its internal repression, end its threats to its neighbors, stop any support for terrorism, abandon its efforts to develop weapons of mass destruction, and comply with UN resolutions. Mobilizing the nations of the world to recognize and address Iraq's threat to peace and stability through new UN action and common commitment to assure that Iraq abides by its commitments is a legitimate and necessary alternative to the unilateral use of military force." Now, all that is quite true. But it seems to me that this is a pious wish and not a serious moral attempt to deal with the concrete situation in which we find ourselves. Of course, we all agree that the Iraq should be made to change its behavior. But nothing short of warfare, at this point, it seems to me, is likely to produce that result. The bishops also said, "Is it wise to dramatically expand traditional moral and legal limits on just cause to include preventive or preemptive uses of military force to overthrow threatening regimes or to deal with the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction? Should not a distinction be made between efforts to change unacceptable behavior of a government and efforts to end that government's existence?" Now, surely, yes, such distinctions should be made. But for the serious statesman, there's also the responsibility to judge when a regime is beyond the possibility of change and still threatens not only us but other people around the world. The bishops, I think, rightly recognize that to apply such thinking in the case of Iraq would expand what in recent decades has become the notion of just cause, which I think is unfortunately, and I'm a Catholic myself, has become a far too narrow approach to what constitutes just cause. At the time of Iraq I, as Jerry describes it, voices in the Vatican were giving the impression that the only time in which you could engage in military action, defensive action, was while, or at least gave this impression, that you could only engage in such an action while that aggression was underway. And once it had taken place, then you kind of negotiate. I don't think that that's what the just war tradition in the Catholic Church or more generally dictates, and I don't think that even the Catholic Church itself always means to say precisely that, but that's the impression that is given by certain religious leaders. My bishops, I think, differ with President Carter on the idea of what it is that warfare actually is. President Carter mentioned in Oslo that warfare is an evil, if sometimes a necessary evil. I don't think that that's the case in the just war tradition. If it were so, I think that lots of us who believe in the scriptures would have to say that if warfare is an evil, no evil can be done, that good can come of it. But if warfare is in itself one of the moral means by which we seek to reshape situations that are less than ideal in a fallen world, then in and of itself warfare has a kind of a standing as a moral tool that we want to parse out very carefully in this new situation in which we find ourselves. And in fact, if we think about this in terms that are closer to home, if, say, a law enforcement officer is to shoot a person who's holding a hostage before you can do some harm to that hostage. We don't say that this is a necessary evil or that it is a regrettable escalation of violence. We say that it is something to be applauded. It's something that reinforces the moral community that we want to establish at an international level. Anything other than that really allows international law to be used as a shield, which allows malefactors advantage over those of us who would like to see a more just and peaceful international order. So I'm going to sum up here and just say that I think we can meet just war criteria, last resort, and just cause in cases like this really do put pressure on the tradition, as nuclear weapons did back during the Cold War. But there will be some circumstances, I believe, in which such steps will have to be taken. I don't think we have the moral obligation to wait for a regime like Iraq to make itself so powerful that we can do nothing against it, or that for it to take steps through third parties against places like the United States. We learned in the 20th century, with the rise of movements like Nazism and communism, that in some instances it may be better to engage in preventive action than to wait until threats become more dangerous for us. So I'm going to conclude with two counter-questions to the ones I began with. Obviously, reasonable people may come to different conclusions about this. There are two reasonable people on this panel with me, and I learned a great deal from what they have to say. But I think we can also turn the questions the other way and say, if not Iraq, who? I mean, are there no instances? Are we going to set the criteria so high that we must actually wait for another tragedy to occur before the United States is able to take action? I think that the nature of the regime, which is not a legitimate government in the understanding of just war theory, the just war theory actually works best when you have two relatively morally equal sides going at it. Can the King of France attack the King of England? Can the King of England attack the King of France? To engage in preemptive action against a regime like Saddam Hussein's, it does not seem to me, sets a precedent that a powerful country can go against any government that it does not like. It really establishes the principle that outlaw regimes will not be allowed to continue in their immoral ways. So, if not Iraq, who? And the question, if not now, when? I would say that the United States, and I'm particularly aware of this when I'm in European audiences, the United States actually has a stronger perspective on that question than any other country in the world, because it is the United States of America that at the end of the day will have to pay the price if some action must be taken against a country like Iraq 5 years from now, 10 years from now, rather than today. And with that responsibility and with the fact that we are going to pay the price comes also a certain right to make decisions of when we will go to war. So I think that in my own view, it's our responsibility to deal with Saddam Hussein and the weapons of mass destruction he has developed now, which is to say before he adds a new chapter to the already sad modern history of failure to deal with threats before they become global. Thank you.